The Duke of Avalthorn discovered his marriage was no longer his when his own footman asked him to sign the visitor's register. Not outside a stranger's house, not at some public office, not at an inn where his name meant nothing. At Blackmere House, his house. The house where his father had died, where his ancestors hung in gold frames, where every stone in the west wing bore the vane crest, where servants had once moved at the sound of his boots. And yet at 6 o'clock that grey morning, Cassian Vane stood in the entrance hall wearing last night's evening coat, smelling faintly of another woman's perfume, while a young footman calmly placed a leather-bound book before him and said, "Your name, sir?" Cassian stared at him. For 3 seconds, he did not understand. Then he looked down. The book was open. At the top of the page, in neat black ink, someone had written, "Visitors received under Her Grace's authority." Visitors. The word struck harder than any accusation. Cassian's fingers tightened around his gloves. "You are new," he said. "Yes, sir." "That explains your mistake." The footman did not blush, did not tremble, did not rush to apologize. He only dipped his head. "Her Grace instructed that all gentlemen not currently resident under approved household terms must sign before entry." Cassian's face went still. Approved household terms. Behind him, rain tapped against the open carriage door. His horses steamed in the cold dawn. His valet, who had not dared speak since they left London, lowered his eyes. Cassian had returned from Lady Rosamund Grell's bed less than 2 hours ago. He had left quietly, before her maid came in with chocolate, before Rosamund could wake and ask whether he had spoken to his wife yet, before she could smile that dangerous little smile and remind him that some women were born to be hidden while others were born to be replaced. He had meant to come home, bathe, change, sleep, and then decide what to do about his Duchess. Instead, his Duchess had already decided what to do about him. "I am the Duke of Avalthorn," he said. The footman looked at him as one might look at a gentleman who had stated a fact both true and irrelevant. "Yes, sir." "Sir." "Not your grace." "Not my lord." "Sir." A thin heat rose in Cassian's face. "Fetch Pritchard. Mr. Pritchard is no longer in service." That sentence was the first crack in the world. Pritchard had been butler of Blackmere House for 21 years. Pritchard had served Cassian's father, lied for Cassian's youth, hidden Cassian's indiscretions, and opened doors before Cassian reached them. If Blackmere had a pulse, Pritchard had carried it in a silver tray. "No longer in service?" Cassian repeated. "Yes, sir." "Who dismissed him?" "Her Grace." The second crack. Cassian stepped fully inside. At once, the smell of the house offended him. Not because it was unpleasant. Because it was clean. No cigar smoke. No stale brandy. No heavy masculine dampness buried in velvet curtains and old carpets. The hall smelled of beeswax, lemon oil, rain-wet roses, and bread fresh from the ovens. It smelled like a house that had been washed of him. He looked around. The portraits had been moved, not removed. That would have been rebellion too crude to ignore. Moved. His father, the late Duke, no longer hung in the place of honour above the staircase. The old man's portrait had been shifted to the east wall, where the morning light exposed every cruel line in his face. In his place hung Cassian's mother. Lady Helena Vane, pale and elegant in blue silk, looked down over the hall as though she had waited 20 years to be returned to command. Beneath her portrait stood a vase of white lilies. His mother had loved lilies. His father had hated them. Cassian had never remembered either fact. His wife had. That irritated him more than it should have. "Where is the Duchess?" he asked. "In the West Library. At this hour." "Yes, sir. With whom?" The footman paused. That pause was too careful. "With Mr. Harbury, Mr. Vale, Mrs. Elwick, and the steward." Cassian's eyes narrowed. "Solicitors?" "Yes, sir." The word moved through the hall like a blade being drawn. Cassian did not wait for permission. He walked past the register without signing. The footman did not stop him. That made it worse. Because stopping him would have been insolence. Letting him pass meant they were certain the trap was already closed. He strode toward the West Library, his boots striking the marble too loudly. The house did not echo as it used to. Carpets had been changed, runners replaced. The cracked urn by the staircase was gone. The old hunting spears had been taken down from the corridor. In their place hung framed estate maps, tenant lists, and a painted view of the South Orchard. A house once decorated for pride had been reorganized for use. Cassian reached the West Library. The doors were open. Inside, his marriage had already been placed on the table. Marianne Vane, Duchess of Avalthorne, stood beside the long mahogany desk with seven tied documents arranged before her. She wore a dark green morning dress, plain at the throat, severe at the wrist. Her hair was pinned low. Her face was calm. Too calm. A woman betrayed should have been pale. A wife abandoned should have looked wounded. A duchess whose husband had spent the night in another woman's bed should have trembled, accused, pleaded, or looked away. Marianne did none of these things. She looked at him as if he were late for an appointment she had never doubted he would miss. Cassian, she said. His name. Not your grace. Not my lord. Not husband. Cassian. The solicitors bowed. The steward lowered his head. A housekeeper he did not know stood beside a silver tray covered with keys. Cassian looked at the tray, then at the papers, then at the wall, and stopped. The wedding portrait was gone. For 6 years, it had hung above the West Library fireplace, Cassian standing proud in black, Marianne seated in ivory silk, his gloved hand resting on the back of her chair. The painting had made him look protective. It had made her look possessed. Now only a pale rectangle remained where the frame had been. "Where is the portrait?" he asked. "In storage," Marianne answered. "Why?" "Because it was the first term I changed." His jaw tightened. "The portrait was not a term." "Yes," she said, "it was. It told everyone who entered this room how our marriage was to be understood." Cassian looked at her. "And how is it to be understood now?" Marianne placed her hand on the first document. "That is what we are here to discuss." He almost laughed. The impulse came from habit, not amusement. He had laughed at women before when they tried to make pain sound official. Laughter had always worked. It made them smaller. It made their anger look theatrical. But this room was full of ink. Ink did not shrink when mocked. "You summon solicitors before breakfast," he said. "No," Marianne replied. "I summoned them yesterday. You chose to arrive after dawn." The housekeeper's eyes dropped. Cassian felt the perfume on his collar like a confession. He removed his gloves slowly. "Leave us." No one moved. That was the third crack. Cassian turned his head toward the steward. "I said leave us." The steward did not obey. Instead, he looked at Marianne. Only then did Cassian understand. He had not simply lost affection. He had lost command. Marianne gave a small nod. "Not yet." The steward remained. The solicitors remained. The housekeeper remained. Cassian felt something old and violent rise in him, the inherited outrage of every vain man who had ever mistaken obedience for nature. "You forget whose house this is," he said. "No," Marianne answered. "That was the first sentence my solicitor advised me to correct." Mr. Harbury, the older solicitor, cleared his throat. "Under the activated settlement provisions, Blackmere House is presently under Her Grace's domestic authority." Cassian turned slowly toward him. "Activated?" "Yes, Your Grace." "At whose request?" "At Her Grace's lawful instruction." Cassian looked back at Marianne. "What have you done?" She did not answer immediately. Instead, she lifted the first document. "The household authority has been transferred. The second, your unlimited access to marital funds has been suspended. The third, your residence has been restricted to the East Wing unless invited elsewhere. The fourth, no woman publicly connected to your name may enter this house. The fifth, no jewels, horses, property, or money from my dowry may be gifted, pledged, sold, or used to settle debts not approved by me. The sixth, you may not dismiss, command, threaten, or reward any servant attached to my household authority. The seventh, Her fingers rested there longest. And if you violate these terms, the separation clause becomes immediate. Cassian stared at her. For a moment, the words did not arrange themselves into meaning. Then they did. You changed every term of our marriage. No, Marianne said. I activated the terms you signed without reading. The room went silent. A memory rose. Not a full memory, only pieces. The wedding morning. A side chamber behind the chapel. His mother impatient near the window. Marianne seated in white with her hands folded tightly in her lap, papers pushed toward him. His solicitor saying, "Standard protections, Your Grace." Cassian dipping the pen. Signing once. Twice. Again, barely looking. He had been thinking of the wedding breakfast, the headache behind his eyes, the race meeting he would miss, and the fact that his new wife looked pretty when frightened. He had not read. Why would he? Men like him inherited power. They did not inspect it. Marianne watched the realization enter his face. She did not smile. That almost broke him more than satisfaction would have. You tricked me, he said. No, she answered. I waited 6 years for you to become the kind of husband who reads what binds him to a wife. You did not. The solicitor placed another paper before him. Cassian did not touch it. What is that? Acknowledgement, Mr. Harbury said. His Grace may sign voluntarily. And if I refuse? Marianne's voice was quiet. Then I file before noon. For separation. Yes. The word did not shout. It simply stood there. Separation. 6 years of marriage, reduced to a legal door. Cassian looked at his wife's hands. Her left hand was bare. No wedding ring. He felt a strange, sharp panic. Where is your ring? In the strongbox. You removed it? Yes. Why? Marianne's eyes lifted. Because I finally understood that a ring can be worn as a vow or as a shackle. I had been wearing yours as the wrong one. No one breathed. Cassian took one step toward her. The housekeeper moved. Only slightly. But enough. A woman he did not know had just prepared herself to stand between him and his wife. The humiliation was complete. And still, beneath it, something worse lived. Not rage. Fear. Because Cassian had seen Marianne wounded before. He had seen her look down when his name appeared beside another woman's in London whispers. He had seen her go quiet when he returned late. He had seen her fold letters he never answered. He had seen her sit alone at dinners where every guest knew more about his pleasures than she did. But he had never seen her protected. Until now. What do you want from me? He asked. It came out lower than he intended. Marianne looked at the empty space where their wedding portrait had hung. I wanted many things from you once. He said nothing. Her eyes returned to him. A letter answered. A dinner attended. A promise remembered. A room entered as though I were in it. A marriage not treated as furniture. Each sentence was calm. Each one cut. But I no longer build terms from wanting. She pushed the acknowledgement toward him. These are not wishes, Cassian. They are conditions. He looked at the paper. His name had already been written neatly at the top. Cassian Vane, Duke of Avalthorne, husband by law, resident by permission. Resident by permission. His throat tightened. You would make me a guest in my own house? No, Marianne said. You made yourself absent. I merely changed the language to match the truth. He looked around the room, at the solicitors, at the steward, at the unknown housekeeper. At the keys no longer his, at the place where their wedding portrait had been removed like a body from a room after death. Then he looked at his wife. For the first time since he had met her, he did not see the quiet woman his mother had chosen. He saw the woman who had survived him. Do you hate me? He asked. Marianne's answer came without drama. No. Something in him almost relaxed. Then she finished. Hate still keeps a room for you. I have needed the space. Cassian could not answer. Outside, the rain strengthened against the windows. Inside, Marianne placed the pen beside the document. You may sign, she said, or you may leave. He looked at the pen. He thought of Rosamond asleep in London, one hand across silk sheets, certain he would return to her with stories of a wife conquered by tears. He thought of Pritchard dismissed. His portrait moved. His seat changed. His ring locked away. His name, still powerful in Parliament and London clubs, suddenly useless in the one house where he had expected it to be enough. Cassian picked up the pen. His hand did not shake. Not yet. He signed. The scratch of ink sounded louder than thunder. When he finished, Marianne took the paper and handed it to Mr. Harbury. Then she turned to the housekeeper. Mrs. Elwick, show His Grace to the East Wing. The words struck him harder than the document, not because she had removed him from her rooms, because she had not even said it cruelly. She had simply placed him where the new terms said he belonged. Cassian stared at her. Marianne, she looked at him. For one second, just one, he saw the woman he had married beneath the Duchess she had become. Not weak, not softened, only tired. Then she was gone again. Yes? He did not know what he meant to say. Forgive me. Wait. Do not do this. I did not understand. I did not mean to lose everything in one morning. But every sentence sounded like theft. So he said nothing. Marianne nodded, as if silence was exactly what she expected from him when words would finally cost something. Mrs. Elwick stepped forward. This way, Your Grace. Cassian followed. At the library door, he turned once. Marianne had already returned to the papers. His wife did not watch him leave. That was the worst part. Not the register. Not the solicitors. Not the missing portrait. Not the ring in the strongbox. The worst part was that Marianne Vane, who had once looked toward every door hoping he would enter, now lowered her eyes to her work before he was even gone. And as the Duke of Avalthorne walked toward the East Wing like a guest under supervision, he understood the first true term of his new marriage. He could no longer enter by being powerful. He would have to become worthy of being invited. By sunset, the Duke of Avalthorne had learned that being powerful in a house was different from being obeyed inside it. His rooms in the East Wing were not cold. That would have made rebellion easier. They were comfortable, clean, and mercilessly impersonal. A bed with fresh linen, a writing desk, a wardrobe, a washstand, two chairs, no decanter of brandy waiting as it once had, no silver bell within reach, no private key to the West Passage, no portrait of his ancestors to remind him that generations of vain men had owned everything they touched. On the desk lay three items: a copy of the terms he had signed, a plain brass key, and a note written in Marianne's hand. Access beyond the East Wing is by invitation only. Cassian read it once. Then again. The handwriting was the same as it had always been, elegant, controlled, slightly slanted to the right. How many letters had she written to him in that hand? How many had he left unanswered? He set the note down. Then, with a violence that surprised even him, he swept the papers from the desk. They scattered across the carpet like fallen leaves. For one moment, the old satisfaction came. Destruction. Noise. Proof that his temper still had weight. Then no one came running. No footman burst in. No valet appeared. No frightened maid stooped to gather the pages. The silence after his anger was perfect. Cassian stood in the middle of the room, breathing hard, and understood that fury without an audience was only embarrassment. Slowly, he bent and picked up the papers himself. That was his first lesson. The second came at dinner. At 7, he entered the long dining room and found only one place set. At the far end of the table. Not the head. Not beside Marianne. Halfway down, beneath a portrait of some long-dead aunt, whose painted expression suggested she had expected better from him, Cassian stopped. The butler, new, composed, older than the footman but equally immune to fear, bowed. Her Grace dines in the West breakfast room this evening. With whom? Alone, Your Grace. Then why am I here? Her Grace understood you would require dinner. Require, not desire. Not command. Require. Cassian looked at the single place setting. This is absurd. Yes, Your Grace, the butler said, with the tone of a man agreeing only with the weather. Cassian almost dismissed him. Then remembered he could not. The terms had been clear. He could not dismiss, command, threaten, or reward any servant attached to Marianne's household authority. His own house had become a country where he did not speak the language. He sat. Soup was served. Carrot. Cassian hated carrot soup. He lifted the spoon halfway to his mouth, then paused. Marianne liked carrot soup. He knew that now. Not because she had told him. Because after 6 years of marriage, he had learned his wife's taste only when it was used against him. That thought removed his appetite. Before the second course arrived, shouting broke out in the hall. A woman's voice. Bright, furious, and familiar. Cassian rose so quickly, his chair struck the floor behind him. Lady Rosamond Grell had arrived. She swept into the entrance hall wearing violet silk, though the road was muddy and the hour improper. Her dark hair was arranged beneath a feathered bonnet, her cheeks flushed from anger or cold, her gloves clenched in one hand. She did not look like a woman seeking help. She looked like a woman arriving to collect property. "Where is he?" she demanded. "Where is His Grace?" The footman from the morning stood before her with the visitor's register open. "Your name, madam?" Rosamond stared at him. "Do you know who I am?" "Yes, madam." "Then move. All visitors must be entered before being received." "I am not a visitor." From the staircase, Cassian heard his own words thrown back by fate. Rosamond looked up and saw him. Her expression changed instantly. "Cassian." She said his name as though it still belonged to her mouth. He came down the stairs, aware of every servant listening without appearing to listen. "You should not be here," he said. Rosamond laughed once, sharp and disbelieving. "Not be here? You vanish before dawn, send no note, and now I am told to sign a book like a tradesman. This is not the time." "No," she said, stepping forward. "This is exactly the time." Then Marianne appeared. She did not enter dramatically. That was never her way. She emerged from the west corridor in a black gown without jewels, her hair smooth, her expression calm enough to frighten everyone who had mistaken calmness for weakness. Rosamond turned. For a few seconds, the two women faced each other across the marble hall. Mistress in violet, Duchess in black, the entire house holding its breath between them. Rosamond smiled first. "Your Grace." Marianne inclined her head. "Lady Rosamond, I came to speak with the Duke. This is my household during the active term. You may speak with him from the drive." Cassian closed his eyes briefly. Rosamond's smile hardened. "So it is true. You have turned marriage into account books and locked doors." "No," Marianne said. "My husband turned marriage into absence. I turned absence into evidence." That silenced even the rain. Rosamond's eyes flicked toward Cassian. "Are you going to stand there and let her speak this way?" Cassian looked at Marianne, then at Rosamond. A day earlier, he would have defended himself by defending his mistress. Not from love, but from vanity. A man does not like to admit he has destroyed his peace for someone unworthy of the destruction. But now Rosamond's perfume filled the hall, the same perfume that had clung to him that morning. It no longer smelled like pleasure. It smelled like proof. "You need to leave," he said. Rosamond stared. "What? You should not have come here." Her face changed. "Not to sorrow, to calculation." "So she has frightened you," Marianne said quietly. "No, I have informed him." Rosamond turned on her. "You think papers can erase me?" "No," Marianne replied. "Papers preserve what careless people hope will disappear." Mrs. Elwick entered then, carrying a sealed packet. Rosamond went pale. Only slightly, but Marianne saw it. So did Cassian. "What is that?" Rosamond asked. Marianne took the packet. "Copies." "Of what?" "Your letters." Rosamond's lips parted. Cassian turned to her slowly. "Letters?" Rosamond gave a small laugh. "You gave them to me freely." "Not to her." "No," Marianne said. "You gave them to a maid who had not been paid in 3 months because your brother spent her wages at cards." Rosamond's eyes flashed. "That little thief." "She was a frightened girl," Marianne said, "and unlike some people in this hall, she understood that promises should be written down carefully. Cassian's stomach tightened. What promises? Rosamond looked at him. Do not. Marianne opened the packet. Lady Rosamond discussed a house in Mayfair, an annual allowance, the settlement of her brother's debts, and the possibility of persuading society that she might become Duchess if my position were made impossible. Rosamond's voice dropped. You had no right to read those. No, Marianne said. I had a duty to read what threatened my name, my fortune, and any future child protected by this marriage. Any future child. The hall went colder. Rosamond placed one hand lightly against her stomach. Cassian saw the gesture. So did everyone. Marianne's gaze did not move. Rosamond whispered, "Perhaps you are too late." Cassian felt the words strike him in the chest. Marianne's face remained calm. But now, for the first time all day, he saw the cost of that calm. Her fingers tightened once around the packet. Once. Then released. Lady Rosamond, Marianne said, if there is a child, the law will protect the innocent, but it will not reward manipulation. Rosamond's smile returned, wounded and cruel. Listen to her, Cassian. She speaks of law because she has no warmth left. No wonder you came to me. The insult hit its mark. Not because it was clever, because it was aimed at the oldest wound. Cassian looked at Marianne. For 6 years, he had believed her quietness meant coldness. Her dignity meant distance. Her restraint meant lack of feeling. Now he knew restraint was sometimes all that kept a heart from being publicly butchered. He descended the last step. Enough, he said. Rosamond turned to him. She cannot give you what I can. Cassian's face hardened. What you offered me was flattery with an invoice. The color drained from Rosamond's cheeks. How dare you? No, he said. How dare I? That is the question I should have asked months ago. The hall was silent. Rosamond's eyes filled, but the tears came too quickly. She was skilled at them. Cassian had once mistaken that skill for vulnerability. I loved you, she said. Marianne looked away. That was the first mercy she gave them both. Cassian lowered his voice. No, you studied me. Rosamond slapped him. The sound cracked through the hall. A footman moved forward. Cassian lifted one hand to stop him. Rosamond breathed hard, eyes shining with humiliation. You will regret choosing a locked door over a woman who wanted you. Marianne looked at her again. He has not chosen me, she said. Do not flatter him with that much progress. The words should have humiliated Cassian. They did. But they also saved him from pretending. Rosamond gathered her skirts. This is not finished. No, Marianne said. But your visit is. Mrs. Elwick nodded to the footman. The front door opened. Rain and cold entered. Rosamond looked once more at Cassian, as if giving him his final chance to be foolish. He did not move. She left. The door closed behind her. The house remained silent. Then Marianne turned to the servants. Thank you. That will be all. They dispersed with the graceful speed of people who had just survived witnessing history. Cassian and Marianne stood alone in the hall. His cheek still burned from the slap. He deserved worse. Is it true? Marianne asked. Her voice was quieter now. Not weak, not trembling, but stripped of ceremony. He knew what she meant. The possible child. I do not know. The answer wounded them both. Marianne nodded once. Then you will find out through your solicitor, not through letters, not through visits, not through private meetings. Yes. And if there is a child? He swallowed. Then I will provide what is just. Marianne's eyes lifted. And nothing that steals from me. No. And nothing that allows her to use innocence as a weapon. No. She studied him, perhaps looking for the old Cassian, perhaps hoping not to find him. Then she said, good night. That was all. She turned and walked toward the west corridor. This time, Cassian did not call after her. The next morning, London began to feed. Rumor traveled faster than horses and with less mercy. By breakfast, a scandal sheet had already printed that the Duke of Avalthorne had been refused entry by his own Duchess. By noon, another claimed Lady Rosamond had been expelled from Blackmere House in the rain. By evening, three versions existed. In one, Marianne had attacked Rosamond with a letter opener. In another, Cassian had fainted. In the third, the Duchess had sold the Duke's bedroom furniture to pay his mistress's debts. None were true. All were believed. Cassian expected Marianne to hide. She did the opposite. 3 days later, she held the tenants' winter meeting in the Great Hall. Cassian was not invited to preside. He was invited to attend. The difference nearly choked him. He stood at the side as farmers, widows, tradesmen, and estate workers entered beneath the portraits of his family. They bowed to Marianne first. She listened to complaints about drainage, roof rot, rising grain costs, and the schoolmaster's failing eyesight. She knew names. She knew which children had fever in October. She knew which cottage needed a new hearth. She knew which tenant had lost a cow and which widow's rent had quietly been reduced. Cassian knew none of it. At the end, an old tenant named Mr. Harrow looked toward him and said, not unkindly, "Will His Grace be staying long this time?" The question entered like a knife. This time. Cassian looked at Marianne. She did not answer for him. That was another term, he realized. She would no longer rescue him from the truth. Yes, Cassian said. If Her Grace permits it. The hall shifted. Some eyes widened. Mr. Harrow nodded slowly. Then there's work enough. Yes, Cassian said. I understand. But he did not understand. Not yet. Understanding came in mud. It came in cold mornings riding to the north cottages. It came in ledgers he should have read years ago. It came in discovering that a necklace he had given Rosamond could have repaired four roofs and bought medicine for half the village. It came in Mr. Lorne, the steward, placing accounts before him and saying, "Her Grace covered the shortfall from her personal funds." Cassian stared at the page. Why was there a shortfall? Mr. Lorne hesitated, then answered, "Because Your Grace withdrew funds in June, July, and August. For Rosamond's house. For Rosamond's gowns. For Rosamond's brother. For nights he barely remembered, and debts the estate could not forget." Cassian closed the ledger. "Show me everything." Mr. Lorne did. By the time he finished, Cassian felt older. That evening, he went to the West Library. He knocked. Marianne's voice came from inside. "Yes, it is Cassian. I know. May I enter?" A pause. Then, "You may." She sat at the desk beneath the empty wall where the wedding portrait had once hung. Papers surrounded her. A single candle burned near her hand. Cassian placed the ledger on the table. "I saw the withdrawals." She did not look surprised. "I assumed you would. You paid for the cottages." "Yes." "With your personal funds." "Yes. Why did you not tell me?" Her eyes rose. "I wrote to you." He remembered letters. Folded letters. Unopened letters. Unopened letters. Letters moved from tray to drawer to fire because he had assumed they contained complaints. "How many?" he asked. "Seven." The number sat between them. Seven chances to be decent. Seven chances missed. "I am sorry," he said. Marianne looked at him carefully. "For the withdrawals. For making you carry the cost of my pleasures." Something changed in her face. Only a little. But he saw it because he was finally looking. "That is closer to the truth," she said. Cassian sat opposite her. Not because he was invited. Because she did not tell him to leave. That too had become a kind of permission. "What can I do?" he asked. Marianne leaned back. "The roofs must be finished before the frost. I will see to it. The schoolmaster needs assistance. I will pay for it." "No," she said. He stopped. "Not pay. Attend." "Attend." "The children need books, repairs, and someone to convince the parish that education is not charity thrown downward, but duty owed. You will attend the meeting." He nodded. "And Lady Rosamond?" "Your solicitor will handle her claim. If there is truth, there will be provision. If there is fraud, there will be consequence." Cassian looked down. "You speak as though it does not wound you." Marianne's pen stilled. Then she said, I speak that way because if I sound wounded, men begin arranging my pain into something useful to them. He had no answer. The fire snapped softly. Cassian looked toward her bare hand. The ring was still gone. He did not ask about it. That was the first night he left the West Library without taking more from the room than he had been given. And behind him, after the door closed, Marianne sat very still. Because restraint had saved her, but it had not made her unbreakable. The first time Cassian earned an invitation, he nearly missed it. It came on a Tuesday afternoon in December, folded once, placed on his desk in the East Wing. Her Grace requests His Grace's presence in the schoolroom at 3. Requests. Not commands. Not summons. Cassian read the note 3 times because he had learned that Marianne's words rarely wasted themselves. At 3 precisely, he knocked on the schoolroom door. A child's voice said, Come in! Cassian opened it and found 12 estate children seated on benches, Mrs. Vale, the schoolmistress at the front, Marianne standing beside a stack of new books tied with brown string. The room smelled of chalk, damp wool, ink, and fire smoke. Every child turned to stare. Cassian, who had addressed Parliament without blinking, suddenly felt judged by 12 pairs of merciless eyes. Marianne looked at him. His Grace has come to read the first page. He froze. I have? Her eyes said. You asked what service looked like. The children waited. Cassian took the book. His hands were steady until he saw the title. The History of Useful Men. One boy in the front row whispered, Is he in it? The room went still. Cassian looked at the boy, then at Marianne, whose mouth did not smile but threatened to. No, Cassian said. Not yet. The children laughed. Something loosened. He read. Badly at first. Too formal. Too stiff. Too much like a man performing goodness before witnesses. Then a little girl asked what integrity meant. Cassian stopped. The old answer would have been easy. Honor, principle, reputation. All the words men used when they wanted applause for things women practiced without witnesses. He looked at Marianne, then back at the child. Integrity, he said slowly, is what remains true about you when no one is afraid of you. The schoolroom went quiet. Marianne looked down. Cassian continued reading. After that day, he was invited to the schoolroom every Tuesday. Not because he was charming, because he returned. That became the new measure of him. Not words, not apologies. Return. He returned to the cottages until the roofs were repaired. He returned to the tenants' meetings and spoke less each time. He returned to the schoolroom. He returned to the chapel on Sundays and sat 3 rows behind Marianne until one morning she said without turning, You may sit nearer. I am not a memorial. He moved 1 row forward. She turned her head slightly. 1 row? It seemed the safest amendment. And then Marianne laughed. Not loudly. Not freely. But enough. Cassian looked at the back of her bonnet and felt something inside him break open with grief. How many times had she laughed before he taught her not to waste it on him? In January, the truth about Rosamond arrived. There was no child. There had been a physician's note, yes, but not hers. A borrowed paper. A staged threat. A desperate attempt to secure money before her brother's creditors came for everything. Cassian read the report in the West Library while Marianne sat opposite him. He expected relief. He felt it. But it came tangled with shame, because even a false claim had been possible only because he had made his life available to scandal. Marianne folded the report. She will be dealt with? By the solicitors, Cassian said. Not by me. Good. She asked to see me. Marianne's hand stilled. And? I refused. She looked up. He held her gaze. Not because the terms forbid it, he said, because decency does. For a moment, neither spoke. Then Marianne placed the report into the fire. They watched it burn. Cassian expected some grand feeling when the paper blackened. Instead, there was only silence. After a while, Marianne said, Freedom is quieter than I imagined. Cassian looked at her. Are you free? Her answer came after a long pause. More than I was. He accepted that. It was more than he deserved. By February, Blackmere House no longer felt like a fortress built against him. It felt like a place he was learning to enter properly. He knocked before entering the West Library. He asked before joining Marianne at breakfast. He stopped giving orders through old habit and began making requests that servants could refuse when unreasonable. At first, the servants watched this transformation, the way villagers watch a wolf claim vegetarian principles. With patience, with suspicion, with weapons nearby. But conduct is harder to fake than repentance. Weeks passed, then months. The household did not forgive Cassian. Forgiveness was too intimate a word, but they began to believe in his usefulness. Mrs. Elwick started sending him repair lists. The steward began including him in estate correspondence. Thomas, the footman who had asked him to sign the register, one morning opened the door and said, "Good morning, Your Grace," without the faint edge of punishment. Cassian noticed. He did not overvalue it. That was another lesson. Not every crumb of mercy was a feast. In March, Marianne fell ill. Not severely, the physician said. A chill, exhaustion, overwork. The usual words men used when women had carried too much for too long and the body finally demanded witness. She refused to stay in bed. Of course she did. Cassian found her in the West Library wrapped in a shawl, pale, angry, and attempting to review drainage accounts. "You should be resting," he said. "I am sitting." "You are working." "I can do both." "No," he said softly. "You have done both for years. That is not proof that it should continue." Her eyes sharpened. "Do not manage me." "I am not." "It sounds very much like it." He took a breath. The old Cassian would have insisted. The new Cassian had learned that care without consent can sound like command. "What would help?" he asked. That stopped her. She looked at him as if the question had arrived in a language she had forgotten she knew. "What? What would help, Marianne?" Her face changed. "Not much. Enough." "The tenant letters," she said at last. "They must be answered before Friday. I will draft them. You do not know the details. Then tell me." She hesitated, then pushed the stack toward him. He sat at the table. For 2 hours, she explained names, rents, repairs, histories, grievances, promises. Cassian wrote, slowly, carefully. Once, he made an assumption, and she corrected him. He crossed out the line without defense. By the end, she looked exhausted. "Go to bed," he said. Her eyebrow lifted. He corrected himself. "Will you go to bed if I finish these and bring them for your review tomorrow?" A pause. Then, yes. He finished the letters by midnight. The next morning, he brought them to her sitting room and knocked. She was in bed, pale but awake, a book open in her lap. The sight struck him with unexpected force. Not because she looked fragile, because she looked human. For years he had made her into functions. Duchess, wife, ornament, grievance, silence, judge. Now she was simply Marianne, tired and wrapped in morning light. He placed the letters beside her. She read the first, then the second, then all of them. At the end, she looked at him. "These are good." The praise was small. Cassian felt it like absolution and reminded himself not to be greedy. "I listened," he said. "Yes," she replied, "I can tell." In April, the wedding portrait returned. Not to the West Library, to Cassian's east sitting room. Marianne had it brought there without explanation. The painted Cassian stood proud and careless, one gloved hand resting on the back of Marianne's chair. Painted Marianne sat beneath that hand, eyes lowered, pearls bright at her throat. Cassian looked at it every morning. At first, he hated it. Then he began to study it. The painter had not lied. That was the awful part. The young duke in the portrait had not looked cruel. He had looked comfortable. Comfortable with being above. Comfortable with being watched. Comfortable with a woman beneath his hand. One evening, Marianne found him standing before it. She had come to the East Wing for the first time since the terms changed. Cassian turned at the sound of her step. I was not expecting you. No, she said. I imagine very few people expect inspection from the portrait. He almost smiled, then looked back at it. I want to burn it. I know. You will not allow it. No. Because it is evidence? Because it is history. He looked at the painted Marianne. She looks afraid. She was. The answer landed softly. Cassian closed his eyes. I did not see it. No, she said. You saw obedience and called it peace. He nodded. There was a time he would have defended himself. That time felt far away. What should be done with it? He asked. Marianne came to stand beside him. Leave it where you can see it. For how long? Until you stop wanting distance from the man in it and start taking responsibility for him. He looked at her. And after that? Then perhaps we commission another. His breath caught. Marianne did not look at him. Not to replace it, she said. To answer it. Summer arrived slowly. The gardens opened. The schoolroom windows were propped wide. The tenants' children began to bow to Cassian without fear. Mrs. Elwick permitted Brandy to return to the east wing, one decanter, locked cabinet, key held by Cassian himself. A test. He passed it. Not because he had become saintly, because he had become watchful of the man he could become when unwatched. One evening in June, Marianne invited him to walk by the South Fountain. The same fountain he had once ignored because it had always been there. Now it had been repaired. Water moved again over the stone basin, catching the last gold of evening. Marianne wore a cream gown and no jewels. Her left hand remained bare. Cassian did not look at it too often. He had learned not to stare at locked doors. They walked in silence until she stopped beside the fountain. I reviewed the terms again today, she said. His body went still. Did you? Yes. He waited. Waiting had become his most honest offering. I am not dissolving them. He nodded once. I understand. But I am amending one. Marianne reached into her reticule. When her hand emerged, she held a small velvet pouch. Cassian knew before she opened it. Still, when the ring appeared in her palm, the sight nearly brought him to his knees. Her wedding ring. The one she had locked away, the one he had once thought proof of possession, the one she now held as if deciding whether metal could be taught a new meaning. I will not wear this because society expects it, she said. No, I will not wear it to quiet gossip. No, I will not wear it because you have been useful for several months and men expect reward for basic decency. Cassian's mouth moved, despite himself. That would be a dangerous precedent. Her eyes flicked to him. There it was. Almost a smile. Then seriousness returned. I will wear it only if we both understand what it is now. Cassian's voice lowered. What is it? Not ownership. Not forgiveness completed. Not proof that pain did not happen. She held the ring between them. A term renewed daily. Cassian looked at her hand. Then at her face. You do not have to offer me that. I know. The words were simple. They changed everything. Because she knew. She was not trapped by family. Not trapped by money. Not trapped by fear. Not trapped by silence. Marianne Vane was choosing whether to open a door. And because she was choosing, Cassian understood the ring for the first time. Not as a circle closing, as a promise that could be broken if dishonored. He took it carefully. May I? She extended her hand. His fingers trembled as he slid the ring onto her finger. When it was done, he did not kiss her hand. He waited. Marianne looked down at the ring. Then, after a moment, turned her hand slightly so that her fingers rested against his. Permission. Small. Immense. Cassian bowed his head over their joined hands, not touching them to his lips, not claiming the moment for performance. Only breathing. Marianne, he said. Yes, I love you. The words were dangerous. He knew it. He had made words cheap before. He had spent them in warm rooms and false promises. He had used them to smooth over injury. He had said beautiful things when ugly conduct followed behind. Marianne did not melt, did not forgive him in a single tear, did not rescue him from the weight of what he had said. She only answered, "Then continue learning how." And he did. In autumn, the new portrait was painted. This time, Marianne stood. Cassian sat beside her. The painter first arranged Cassian's hand over hers. Marianne said no. Then he arranged Marianne's hand on Cassian's shoulder. Cassian said no. At last, they settled on something quieter. Cassian seated, one hand open on the chair arm. Marianne standing beside him, her hand resting near his, close enough for warmth, separate enough for choice. The painter frowned. "It is unusual." Marianne looked at Cassian. "Yes," she said. "That is the point." When the portrait was hung, the old one remained nearby. Guests whispered, "Let them." The old portrait showed the marriage as it had been. The new one showed the marriage as it was trying to become. One evening, Cassian found Thomas in the entrance hall closing the visitor's register. The book still rested on the table. Cassian looked at it. The first page still bore his name from that morning months ago. Cassian Vane. Written beneath visitors received under Her Grace's authority. He touched the edge of the page. "Do you still require me to sign?" he asked. Thomas looked toward the west corridor. Marianne had just entered the hall. She heard the question. For a moment, her eyes rested on the register, then on Cassian. "No," she said. The word was quiet. But this time, it did not close a door. It opened one. Cassian looked at her. Marianne stepped forward, took the pen, and drew a single line beneath the last entry. Then she wrote, "Household terms amended by mutual consent." Cassian read it. A strange warmth moved through him. Not victory. Something better. Belonging without conquest. He offered his arm. Not automatically. Not as command. As a question. Marianne looked at it for a long moment, then placed her hand lightly upon his sleeve. The footman opened the front door. Outside, rain fell softly over Blackmere House. Not dramatic rain. Not the kind poets wasted ink upon. Only a thin, steady country rain that silvered the gravel, darkened the stone, and made the whole house seem washed clean enough to begin again. So let us leave them there, dear listener. Not healed by one apology, not saved by one ring, not remade by one grand speech beneath candlelight. Let us leave them in something stronger than romance's easy ending. Practice. A duchess who learned that silence was not safety until she gave it teeth. A duke who returned from another woman's bed expecting a wife, a room, a name, and a house to receive him as before, and found instead a register, a solicitor, a missing portrait, and terms he could no longer ignore. And a marriage that did not survive because the husband was forgiven. It survived because the wife became free enough to choose again, and the husband became humble enough to be chosen slowly. Tell me, which moment stayed with you? Was it the mistress placing her hand over a lie? The duchess saying, "I turned absence into evidence"? The duke reading to the schoolchildren and admitting he was not yet useful? Or the visitor's register finally being closed? Draw your chair closer for the next story. The rain has not stopped. The lamps are still burning, and some houses do not become homes until the person who thought he owned them learns how to knock.